Chapter 3. White Mountain. Falsehoods. Chorus. Once upon an age, the White Mountain might have been known by that name because it was capped by virgin snow. But if so, that era was lost to antiquity. Now, the broad blade-tipped peak was grey-silver from the ashfall that settled from the biting polar winds and moved in scudding dunes across the lifeless landscape. The old dead cinders found their way into anything left beyond the great static webs shrouding the mountain approaches. And each time Garville Loken ventured up to the vantages in the highest caves, he would track a dusty line of them back with him on his return. He let himself get lost in the view from the cavern mouth, his gaze slipping focus until the flatlands beyond became an endless pale forever that he could see without seeing. The Radlands were a dreadful place, if one took them literally, a wasteland left behind after a catastrophic ecocidal war that would have, if it had been left to continue, destroyed all life on Terra, or Earth, as it had been known in the Dark Age of technology. The being who ended that war was not the Emperor of Mankind, or at least he was not at the time, but his legacy remained in this place. The White Mountain had been the lair of that old war's most brutal champion. She had been dead and dust for thousands of years now, but her fortress palace had been repurposed for other needs, and it still served them in good order. It was tranquil here, in its own desolate way. Nothing lived outside, and within, every one of the mountain's laser-cut corridors and domed inner chambers was lined with sense-deadening metals. The deeper one ventured inside, the more robust the effect of the phase iron plates and counter-psionic wards. At the inmost core levels, the stillness was so absolute and unsettling that Loken had been unable to remain there for more than a few hours. It was the absence of everything, from the smallest sound to the most distant whisper of psychic wind. Down there was a giant metaphasic cage they had built to imprison Magnus the Red, crafted to the Emperor's own designs, but few believed they would ever have the occasion to use it. Like the White Mountain itself, the cage was something forged in spite of the inevitable, a reserve, a backup plan in case other better schemes failed. When he first arrived here, Loken wondered why the Sigilite had sent him. Any one of the Knights Errant could have been tasked with the investigation into the recoveries, as they had come to be known. Was it another test? On some level, he knew it had to be. Malkador, Dorn, and others had never truly trusted him since he had been found, gripped by madness on Istvan III. And in truth, there was still a part of Loken that agreed with them. Was it a punishment? He had failed in his last mission to board the vengeful spirit and terminate his genefather and Primarch, the Warmaster Horus Lupercal. Good men had perished there, others scarred and barely able to escape with their lives. For Loken, it was a shameful frustration that haunted him. He had squandered his chance at cutting off the serpent's head, and the inner conflict that ran through him in those charged moments still burned like fire. Would that opportunity ever come again? Over and over he castigated himself with the knowledge that it would not. But as time passed, he thought of the duty differently. The assignment to the White Mountain was not truly a test, not really a punishment. It was a gift. In the silence of the endless dark halls, where errant thought and turbulent emotion themselves were deadened by arcane anti-psychomechanisms and contra-telepathic barriers, Loken rediscovered something like peace. It was fleeting, he knew that, but it centred him. The whispers of insanity that had plagued Loken's mind in the past, that manifested in the voices of his former comrade, Torgadon, the ghost of old Iacton, or the snarls of his lost self, Cerberus, they stayed away. For while Loken's physical injuries from the assault on the vengeful spirit were nothing compared to those sustained by Mesa Varan, Tylos Rubio, or poor Ares Wojtek, The wounds to his spirit and his will were grave. In the tranquility of the White Mountain, those things found a place to be healed. Loken heard footsteps coming up the stairs carved into the rock, but did not turn. He had come to know the distinctive pattern of Teledeon Brell's boots across the stone, the way she would sometimes half-drag her right leg, where its bionic joint shifted slightly out of sync with the rest of the organic limb. She was moving quickly. Something had agitated the scientician, enough that she was willing to break protocol and approach him outside of their normal schedule. "Brell," he said by way of greeting, eschewing any preamble, "do you have something new for me?"
"Work proceeds with the intake,"
she puffed, coming to a halt at his side. The woman was tall for a human, almost as tall as a space marine, but spindle-thin with it. Born of low-grav Hyperionite stock from the Saturnian satellites, Brell had a bone density so thin that she would collapse under her own weight in a Terran-standard G environment. Age of Strife tech devices that projected a counteracting field around her body allowed her to move normally on other worlds. But to Loken, she seemed like a bird with clipped wings, always on the verge of taking flight, but never able. Vapor from her breath coiled in the air as she spoke, the words a rapid-fire chatter more akin to a datum download than a conversation.
"Each day, the cogitator engines form new combinations of the words and sound elements. I feel as if we are on the verge of a great insight. If only we could force the recoveries into some sort of coherence."
"Force them," he echoed. "I've told you before how I feel about that. Deliberately inducing pain or other hardships will not be permitted."
"That may be what is required,"
countered Brell, but Loken spoke over her. "I have not been unclear." This discussion, or something very much like it, was one he and the scientician had gone through on many occasions, and the knight errant was tired of it. "Remember who these people are. Respect them."
"I do, I have, I do," Brell said quickly. "But they are not who they once were, Sir Loken. Surely you see that. Your compassion is laudable but misplaced. Their minds are broken beyond repair."
"That, too, was once said of me," he replied firmly. And the thought occurred that Loken's own voyage into the loss of self and back again might have been behind Malkador's choice of him for this mission. Brell briefly went quiet, as she was wont to do when she was unwilling to concede a point. Then, with an exaggerated shrug, she offered him a look at the data slate in her long-fingered hands.
"Perhaps the addition of a new information vector will alter our perception of the chorus's purpose."
The slate showed the approach clearance authorization for a shuttlecraft, and Loken took it in, before turning back to the view of the wilderness to search the stark skies above. "Yes, there it is." He saw a fast-moving dart streaking in from the southwest, dropping low as it angled towards one of the White Mountain's lower landing moors.
"Another recovery," Brell explained. "In good condition and exhibiting encouraging clarity, so it seems."
Loken didn't like the way she seemed almost eager to get her hands on the new arrival.
"I thought you would want to know, but I can deal with the induction and preliminary processing if you are..."
She drifted off, then gestured at the desolate view.
"Otherwise engaged."
"We'll both go," he said, making it an order. By the time they reached the landing moor, the shuttle was already settled and its passengers had disembarked. The new recovery was like all the others, a ragged-clothed woman with a shaven head and the honorific marks of the sisterhood visible upon her. But she seemed more aware of her surroundings than many of those Loken had seen down in Brell's holding pens. Medicaid servitors and some of the scientician's adjutants were circling the woman, conducting non-invasive scans and examining her for signs of outward trauma. As Loken passed close by, he heard her speaking. Even now, after having seen more than one of these tormented silent sisters sundering their oaths with meaningless babble, to hear them give voice was unsettling.
"Worlds, names, time."
"Oh," said Brell, making the sound with an obvious anticipatory edge.
Very good. This is interesting. More distinct than the others. Very, very good.
Remember what I said. Locum was firm. I will not repeat myself again.
Understood.
Brell bowed, but the way she shifted her weight from foot to foot made it abundantly clear that she wanted to be away to her laboratories to begin testing the unfortunate recovery.
Her name is Melida Chidasian, of the Thunder Vein.
The words were an admonishment, the tone mirroring Loken's. Nathaniel Garrow walked out of the shadows beneath the hissing shuttle and gave his comrade a nod of salutation.
The Sigilite bid me to bring her here.
Brother Captain.
Loken offered Garrow his hand, and he met the gesture with his own in the old manner, wrist guards clanking against one another.
Well met. We can but hope,
Garrow replied, watching like a hawk as the scientician led Jidasian away into the gloom.
I'm heartened to see you here, Garville, he went on. But I have questions.
I don't doubt it.
Loken gave a rueful nod.
So do I. Start by telling me what this place is.
Garrow looked up, taking in the cavern.
The air is dead.
The most concise explanation. The White Mountain is a prison.
Loken started walking, and Garrow fell in step with him.
A jail, repurposed from the remains of an ancient fortress. A prison for what?
Psychers.
Loken tapped a finger to his brow.
That muteness you feel around us? It's the ghost effect of 100 different dampening systems, all designed to smother the power of the ethereal. If you and I can sense it, imagine how it must be for one of them.
Oh.
A flicker of recognition passed over Garrow's face.
I thought it felt familiar. I came across something similar on board the Phalanx. Lord Dawn has a chamber of comparable function, within which he keeps the brothers of his Librarius.
Of course he does, said Loken, his lip curling.
I would expect no less of the Imperial Fists. Is Jidasian a criminal?
Garrow studied him.
Malkador said nothing of the sort, but he spoke of others, found in the same state as she was. Are they here too?
Loken nodded once, and he went on.
More like her. More silent sisters.
All of them.
Garrow halted.
How many?
Loken let out a sigh. His orders had been clear. To pursue the investigation, but to speak of it to no other members of the Knights Errant without Malkador's express permission. And yet, here was Nathaniel Garrow, dispatched by the Sigilite. What was he supposed to do? Thank the battle captain for his diligence and then send him on his way?
This is not a matter for greater dissemination, he began. We are at a critical juncture, and to split our focus would be a mistake.
Garrow folded his arms across his chest and met Loken's gaze.
You speak, but I hear Malkador's voice. No games, Luna Wolf. No obfuscation. You and I are long past such things.
The former Death Guard said nothing more, but in the silence an unspoken truth remained. Garville Loken owed Nathaniel Garrow his life, not just for rescuing him from his self-imposed exile among the ruins of the Istvan massacre, but for having the faith in his spirit, for believing that Loken could come back from the dark madness that had almost broken him.
You once told me that the Emperor protects, said Loken after a moment. I'm not sure he is protecting these unfortunates.
He nodded towards the shadows and the depths of the complex beyond.
They began appearing several months ago. Or perhaps it is more correct to say they began reappearing. Each of the recoveries we have made is a Sister of Silence whose name is listed on their order of battle as missing presumed dead.
Recoveries, Garrow echoed.
That is what you're calling them,
Loken went on.
In each case, a body was never found. Their carders marked their losses as honored casualties of war and moved on.
He frowned, drawing up the facts that had been vexing him since the first day of this assignment.
There is no logic we have been able to discern as to why certain individuals were taken, or the method by which it was done. Each of them has been found on Terra, regardless of where they were lost in the solar system, and each in the same state. Malnourished, barely responsive, able only to repeat a few tones, elements of words or fragmentary sentences.
They have broken their oath and speak as Jidaisian does.
He shook his head.
That is the one factor that differs. No two recoveries utter exactly the same sounds. Brell, the scientician Malkador sent here, she believes there is a pattern to be discerned. Not that she's found it yet.
Garrow said nothing, processing what he had heard. At length he turned to look away.
Is this cruelty the work of the War Master?
It would appear so. Every one of the recoveries has been in proximity to insurrectionist sympathizers, an infiltrator group, or an aberrant manifestation. All of the abducted sisters have been mentally traumatized, their minds broken and remade by brute force.
How is that possible? Said Garrow. They are pariahs, untouchables. Not even the things that live in the warp would be able to enter their psyches.
Aye, that is so, agreed Loken. But there are other ways to twist a human mind, even that of a null. Sanity may be shattered without recourse to metaphysical means.
His frown deepened.
I have first-hand experience.
And so Malkador sent you to watch over this prison because of that.
Garrow gave a nod.
Because Garvil Loken has passed through such a trauma and emerged on the other side of it.
Perhaps.
I've given up trying to fathom the Sigilite's motives. It leaves me with a headache.
Garrow opened his hands and gestured around.
So tell me if you can, what is the end point to all this? Are our aggrieved sisters in battle fit only to be locked away, forgotten amid the smoke and fury of the coming invasion?
He shook his head gravely.
I've seen that happen. Dawn psychers. My own men confined on Luna, on Malkador's orders, left to rot.
His jaws stiffened as his annoyance grew.
This is unacceptable. Unless these recoveries represent a danger, they should not be treated like cattle. The Silent Sisterhood must be told. Every day their kindred are kept from them is a dishonor.
Loken shifted, putting himself between Garrow and the path leading deeper into the White Mountain. It was a subtle motion, but one with a clear martial intent, a veiled warning behind it.
The Sigilite has forbidden us to make contact with the Witch-Seeker Cardas. They are to remain ignorant of this.
Before Garrow could disagree, Loken went on.
This may be part of a larger ploy, even a weapon of some kind. Believe me when I tell you, my Primarch does everything with an order to it. If Horus's hand is in this phenomena, it is turned towards a greater goal we do not yet see.
I repeat my previous question,
Garrow said firmly.
What is the end point? What if Horus arrives before your scientician's answers?
There is a contingency in place. A termination protocol.
Garrow's expression turned to stone.
You would do so.
He pressed down on his clear anger at the words.
The Sisterhood have put their lives on the line countless times in the name of the Imperium and Terra. How can you conscience putting them to death, forgotten and unremarked in this desolate prison?
It is not something I relish the thought of, Loken shot back. But the Sigilite left little room for interpretation of the order.
Despite his own antipathy to the command, Loken was resigned towards the deed if it needed to be done, and Garrow's annoyance chafed on him, as if the blame for this could all be laid at Loken's feet.
Not all of us have the freedom to defy Malkador as you have.
Garrow's eyes widened at the accusation in his words.
In all my years of service to the Emperor, I have never defied a lawful, honourable order, he said firmly.
This is not a matter of law, Loken told him, as a line silently drew itself between them.
If you had seen this war from the same place as I, you would know so.
The density of the jungle across the Demerara downland made it necessary for Rubio and the others to move slower than he would have liked. The thickets of tall hardy trees required care to navigate, as cutting a path would have not only consumed more time, but also what stealth they had at hand. Instead, the three knights-errant moved with care as toxin rain sluiced down from the canopy far above, the fat yellow droplets spattering off the polymerized cowls of their falsehoods. Each of them was lost in the shadows of the camouflage cloaks, a trio of identical ceramite-clad forms advancing step by step into the wilds of the acid rainforest. Galor was on point, his bolter at the ready beneath the folds of his cloak, and Varan took up the rear, his head scanning left and right as he turned his hunter's sense to watching for threats. Rubio held the middle ground, but in actuality his body was moving like an automaton while his thoughts were elsewhere. The Psyker's mind was detached from his physical form, adrift out on a perimeter hundreds of metres distant, and it wove through the stands of trees, resting here and there as though it were a pollinator flitting from plant to plant. Life, of a sort, teemed out here, just below the muddy surface of the earth, or in the vast network of deep taproots that fed into the trees. Hardy reptiles and scuttling insects, things with dense skins and tough carapaces that had evolved to survive in the polluted, radiation-scarred outlands of Terra. There were few domains on the throne world that could still be considered truly wild, but this was one of them. Hundreds of thousands of years before, the downland had been an abyssal plain below fathoms of ocean water. Those mighty seas had shrunk to shallow ghosts of their former glory, revealing these scarred wastes to the punishing light of a pitiless sun. For all its miracles and monuments, for all its great works and human accomplishments, Rubio had always been disenchanted with Terra. Outside the hive cities, the greater enclaves and the majesty of the imperial palace, the birthplace of mankind was a scarred and bitter sphere. Compared to verdant, glittering Macragge, it seemed ancient and unwelcoming. He frowned at the thought and pushed it away. Rubio wore the cerulean of the 13th no longer. Macragge was not his to remember. He focused instead on the mission at hand. They were here, following a lead gathered from the survivors of the Walking City, a clue that might reveal more of the mystery shrouding the broken Sister of Silence. He drew back to himself, and from behind, Rubio heard Varan give a grunt of irritation as he followed the Psyker over the bole of a fallen trunk.
"Damn this place," he went on. "I should have stayed behind with Ison."
Rubio said nothing. Varan's complaints were part of his nature, but they had become more noticeable since he returned to battle duty after reviving from his Sassan coma. He suspected that Varan's wounds were not as healed as the other warrior insisted, and that his eagerness to get back into the field had clouded the former World Eater's judgment. But to suggest that aloud would be to draw open an argument that would benefit no one. Rubio decided instead to remain watchful and keep his own counsel. For his part, Vardas Ison's duty in the Walking City would be to enforce the last few elements of their orders from Malkador, securing the wrecked metropolis before moving on. Stranded as it was now in the snowy highlands, much of the city's surviving populace were already fleeing back towards warmer latitudes. When they left, Rubio had seen long lines of the displaced snaking down the peaks from the window of their shuttle. Even though they had expunged the threat, the end result was still a victory for the invaders. The Walking City was hobbled, and the shadow cast by Horus across Terra grew a little larger in the hearts and minds of the common people. Rubio and the others had arrived in the jungle 2 days ago, and marched without halt from the moment their shuttle climbed away into the sky. Now they were close to the coordinates that the Psyker had plucked from the mind of the smuggler Galor had captured, trying to escape. The very man that other survivors had identified as the jailer of the woman Gidasian. Rubio knew him on sight, having assembled a memory of his face from the partial recall of the witnesses. He broke easily, and they had Varan to thank for that. The warrior had shown the smuggler a blade and told the man what could be done with it. That was all it took. "Hold here!" Rubio hadn't spoken for a while, and the words came out coarsely. Galor dutifully dropped into a crouch, and Varan grimaced as Rubio surveilled the camp through the eyepiece of a monocular scanner. The trees thinned a few hundred metres distant from the team's concealment, opening into a cluster of shallow connected craters overgrown by hardy plant life. Away beyond that, across the hollows in the ground, there were vast corroded arches, the skeletal remnants of great ship hulls gnawed upon by time and acid deluges. Little of the original form of the ancient vessels could be determined, but they must have dated back to the ages when the seas covered this landscape. In among the old frames lay an encampment, just as the smuggler remembered it, a mess of cube-shaped container pods repurposed as shelter beneath a wide, undulating plastic shroud. Alongside, there were a pair of spider-like transit crawlers and a makeshift landing pad. On the pad, an interplanetary hauler, shaped like a winged bolt shell, sat on its tail thrusters, the craft's bionic nose glistening in the bitter rain. The smuggler knew that ship. Inside, it smelled of lubricant and stale propellant.
"Plasma drives on it," noted Galor, studying the craft. "They would carry it to the inner worlds and back."
"Aye," said Rubio. "And it is of small enough tonnage that it could make it through the security web around Mercury."
"I see movement."
Varan came closer and pointed.
"Look, there."
He indicated a pair of figures in bulky environment suits, moving sluggishly near the edge of the great tent. It was impossible to determine any details about them, the faceplates set to the darkest possible polarization.
"That's vacuum gears averring," Galor added. "But the air here is breathable."
He glanced back at Rubio.
"Protection from the rains?"
Rubio did not answer, and instead let his senses probe further ahead. He thought of the smuggler and the other criminals they had interrogated back in the Walking City, expecting that he would sense the same colours of persona here, the chatter of undisciplined minds, the base focus of the rough, the cunning and the violent. But at first pass, there was nothing. He scowled, refocusing his psyche to push deeper, and at once a different pattern made itself apparent. Another Psyker. Rubio's hands rose in a defensive kata, instinctively drawing on a well of telepathic force to defend himself. In the same moment, Galor and Varan reacted as a piece of the wet jungle moved strangely and detached itself. They aimed their weapons into the shimmer of what could only be another falsehood.
"Hold!"
Rubio repeated. The new arrival radiated mild, superior amusement rather than malice, and it gave him pause.
"Show yourself," he went on.
The cloak faded and presented the trio with another legionary, his armour the same storm grey as theirs. The warrior approached and dropped into a crouch. Light flickered from the matrix of psionically attuned crystals around the back of his head.
"They do not know we are here," he said.
"Who in this serious dust are you?"
demanded Varan.
"An ally."
Rubio did not recognize the other legionary's voice, but his battle plate and the mark of the sigillite upon it were authentic, scanned and confirmed by the optical sensors in his helmet.
"Why did you come?"
he went on.
"I need no support."
"Give me your name," said Rubio.
"Jotun,"
came the reply. But there was a noticeable pause before it, as if this knight-errant found it a poor fit.
"You are Koyos, yes?"
"Rubio,"
he corrected. He thought he heard the undertones of a Fenrisian accent in the other warrior's words, but the timbre of the voice through a helmet filter made it hard to be sure.
Ah, yes. Of course. Jotun looked away. I see now. You did not expect to find me here?
Doing what exactly? Asked Galor.
Jotun waved vaguely in the direction of the smuggler camp.
Observing.
We've walked a long way to find this place.
Varan was clearly irritated by Jotun's relaxed demeanor.
If you have anything useful to say, Psyker, then do so. Otherwise, we go in there and tear it apart.
What do you expect to find?
The question was aimed at Rubio.
I'll know it when I see it, he replied.
Jotun gave a low chuckle.
I will help you then. Lead on.
Varan moved away with Galor to approach from the south, and Jotun fell in with Rubio. For a moment he questioned the tactical value in splitting the group into Psyker and non-Psyker pairs, but the telepathic stillness from inside the encampment made it seem unlikely he would have to face a psionically empowered opponent. Rubio was not expecting a hard fight, but bitter experience warned him not to be complacent. For now, the Knights Errant had the element of surprise on their side, and they would employ it to maximum advantage. All of them pulled up their falsehoods and let the techno-cloaks blend their shapes into the dull green colours of the jungle. Motion was slow and methodical, for while the cloaks could render even the mass of a fully armoured space marine invisible, they could not disguise movement. A guard with a keen eye might see the warping of the vegetation and raise the alarm if they went too quickly.
"When did you take Malkador's mark?"
Jotun said quietly, breaking the silence.
"I was one of the earliest," Rubio replied. "After Garrow."
"Garrow wasn't the first," Jotun said with a sniff. "Not in a chronological sense."
"You asked the question. Does that matter?"
Jotun shrugged.
"I've heard of you, Tylos Rubio. Gilliman's discommended son. The one who walked away from Kalth and never looked back."
"I've looked back," Rubio amended. "But it serves nothing."
Now halfway across the brush-snarled crater, the two of them had little cover. He picked out paths of egress in the event that someone started shooting, but they were poor. It would be better odds to storm forward, if it came to it, and battle through any incoming fire.
"Good," Jotun said. "The path you and I are on leads to the future. Look forward, cousin. Always forward."
Rubio hesitated, watching one of the suited figures cross his path up ahead.
"You speak like you know me, and yet I have no friends among the sons of Russ."
Jotun gave that low chuckle again.
"I am not a wolf." He tapped his armour. "We are knights, all."
Rubio turned back to glance at the other warrior.
"What is your real name?"
The amusement dropped out of the reply.
"Here and now, only Jotun. Looking back serves nothing. You said it yourself."
"Aye."
The shambling, bulky human shape of the suited smuggler disappeared out of sight behind a cargo container, and Rubio swiftly moved forward, reaching the edge of the great tent that covered most of the encampment. The two psykers slipped around piles of loose storage pods, venturing deeper within. His hand on the hilt of his Gladius Force sword, Rubio reached out once more with his ephemeral senses and tried again to gauge the emotions of the smuggler clan. Death. The Stygian cold of corpses. The rot of a breath from a cracked tomb. These were the impressions that assailed him, and he reeled from the sudden effect.
"You feel that?"
whispered Jotun. And by his tone, Rubio knew that the other warrior was experiencing the same thing. He nodded woodenly.
"Something is very wrong here."
"Look up,"
Jotun said gravely, and pointed. Rubio twisted around to get a better angle. The plastic shroud over the camp had been secured to the rusted frames of the old ships by dozens of thick hawsers, but the surplus lengths of those cables had been left to hang towards the ground. Bodies were strung from the ends of them, and the grotesque counterweights swayed in the breeze. The dangling corpses were bloated and rancid with decay, and Rubio's blood ran cold when he saw the glint of tiny, iridescent insect bodies crawling over the pallid flesh of the dead. He looked away, finding a great corroded section of hull metal that had likely been the conning tower of an ancient sea-going freighter. Inverted and half-buried in the crater floor, it had been converted by the smugglers into a strongpoint of sorts, and harsh sodium lights burned in the hollows worn wide by age.
"In there?"
Jotun nodded, making the same tactical evaluation.
"Silent weapons only."
"Aye."
Rubio drew his force sword, deliberately keeping the flow of psionic energy to it at a low ebb. Jotun had a blade of his own, but his was an axe with a wicked half-moon head that shone with an inner light.
"Rubio, respond!"
Varen's rough voice grated over the Vox channel.
"Go on,"
he replied.
"We have a number of the smugglers in sight. They're standing around doing nothing. They're not aware of us."
"Understood. Alert me if the situation changes."
"Watch yourself around the stranger," Varen warned.
"Just because he has the Sigilite's mark, it doesn't mean you have to trust him."
Rubio glanced at the impassive mask of Jotun's helmet, struck by the sense that behind it the other warrior was grinning at him.
"The thought had occurred," he said,
and cut the channel. Moving in, they met no resistance and spied no guards. That in itself was a warning, stoking Rubio's tension still higher. His grip tightened around the hilt of his gladius. Picking their way through the corroded upside-down passageways was difficult, and their bulk made it necessary for the armoured warriors to move in single file. Thus, Rubio was the first to come across what he would later describe as the laboratory. It had probably been a mess hall in the ancient days, when the ship plied those long evaporated oceans. The discoloured remains of benches and tables were bolted to the floor over their heads, but the inverted ceiling on which they walked had been laid out with half a dozen restraint chairs, bristling with clamps and unpleasant-looking surgical tools on the end of angled gimbals. Hollow cowls, hood-like devices that could envelop a human head and project lifelike virtual imagery directly into the retina, drooped here and there, some still blinking with activity. Rubio knew this kind of machinery. He dimly remembered it from an old past, a before time that had been almost completely chemically erased from his mind. As a boy, when he had only been human instead of transhuman, machines like these had started him on the path to becoming a member of the Legiones Astartes. While other technology and invasive alterations had opened up his body to implant new and more powerful bio-engineered organs, devices like these had implanted new knowledge in his mind. Through hypnagogic therapies, psychogrammetric programming and re-education, the young Tylos Rubio had absorbed centuries of military knowledge, tactics, abstract training, and more. But such technology, if turned upon a being without the enhancements of a space marine, could have terrible damaging effects. Jotun fingered one of the cowls, then discarded it.
"I had not thought to ever see these again."
There was that accent again, with the hard edges of the rout forcing through each utterance.
"Do you follow, Rubio? This is a chamber of agonies. Those brought here are robbed of their self."
Just like Jidaisian, thought Rubio. And then a cold and unpleasant conclusion came to him. The source of the dead, psychically barren atmosphere in this place was, paradoxically, coming from something alive. And if that was so, there was only one thing it could be.
"You feel that?"
Jotun seemed to intuit his train of thought. Rubio nodded, forcing himself to push out his telepathic senses against the heavy negative weight of the null effect all around him. The dark void took on a hazy shape, coalescing a distance away beyond a hatch in the far wall.
"In there."
Jotun gave a terse nod and approached the hatch. With quick, economical moves of his axe, he chopped off the hinges and left bright new metal visible in the dimness. Rubio stepped up and slid the great door off its mount as quietly as he could. That ephemeral tomb wind gusted out of the opening, and he followed Jotun inside. The next room was a metal chamber that had once been a huge meat locker. Now it was filled with cube-shaped cages, piled atop one another in poor order. Most were empty, but several were occupied by emaciated figures in tattered rags. Each prisoner had the shaven pate and honour tattoos of the Silent Sisterhood, and it angered Rubio to see them so poorly treated. Jotun didn't wait, immediately moving from cage to cage, snapping off locks that kept them confined. Those he freed stumbled from their tiny prisons, not acknowledging the legionaries or each other, their faces blank and their eyes vacant. All of them were speaking, some in mutters, others in crack-throated whispers. Rubio strained to listen, trying to pick out pieces of what seemed like whole words in among a murmuring, incoherent chorus. Unlike Jidaisian, it was impossible at first pass to grasp what meaning there might be.
"Now we know why there was nothing to sense here," said Jotun. "Pariahs."
He said the word with open repulsion, and Rubio shared his antipathy.
"Indeed."
He faltered as he began to speak, glimpsing sudden unexpected motion at the open hatchway behind them. Rubio pivoted, catching sight of a figure in a bulky environment suit. Silhouetted against the glow of biolooms in the other chamber, it was a thick-set and ungainly form, and yet it reacted with speed. Skidding, half-sliding away, the suited figure ran back towards the corridors beyond. The warrior stormed after the smuggler and spun his gladius in his hand, bringing it up for a downward killing blow. His strike was true, piercing the suit's backpack, stabbing through the spine and out of the chest, impaling the smuggler before they could get away. But something was wrong. The blade met little resistance as it cut, and the figure distorted as it fell, losing shape. The black-visored helmet struck the deck and cracked open, and from it burst a torrent of glistening, shrieking flies. The suit deflated, becoming a sloughed skin, and the torrent of insects screamed away into the corridor. Striding in after him, Jotun came forward and kicked away the broken helmet. The blackened, corrupted form of a half-consumed skull was visible inside it.
"Another new horror for the reckoning," he said with a grimace.
Rubio heard answering screeches coming from all around, echoing down the passages of the ancient wreck, and a moment later, Varen's voice was growling in his ear.
"Rubio! The smuggles are... something... screaming... I see a dozen or more. They're coming your way!"
He hesitated, weighing his options. This was clearly a manifestation event, and what passed for standing orders among the knights errant called for such locations to be fully cleansed of all taint, even if that meant losing innocence into the bargain. But Rubio was not about to let these captives perish, not when there were still so many questions that they might hold answers for.
"Varen, Gallor, converge on this location. We're coming out with non-combatant rescues."
He shot Jotun a look.
"Get them to safety, yes?"
Jotun cocked his head.
"And what do you intend to do?"
Down the corridor, metal rang and clattered as the enemy came swarming towards them.
"I'll slow them down,"
said Rubio, bringing his force sword up to battle ready. Varen sprinted around the edge of the encampment with Gallor at his heels, both of them laying down fire towards anything that moved, but each shot ripped straight through the suited figures and kept on going, blasting harmlessly into the distant tree line. Buzzing black smoke coiled from the entry and exit wounds, and overhead the dangling bodies writhed and shook in grotesque sympathy. He looked up and saw swollen bellies burst, revealing breeding masses of fat maggots and more newborn carrion flies streaming into the air.
"Curse this!"
Varen scowled.
"By my life, I have never wanted a heavy flamer more than I do now. Look there!"
Gallor jabbed a finger towards a ragged hole in the side of the fallen coning tower. As a loose stream of gaunt walking wounded stumbled out into the light, with the stranger called Jotun herding them forward.
"Where's Rubio?"
Varen demanded, his bolter rising, ready to believe the worst of this unfamiliar warrior. Jotun used his axe to point back towards the wreck of the ancient ship.
"Buying us time to save these luckless souls,"
he shot back.
"There are cargo crawlers on the eastern side of the encampment. Get the sisters aboard and make for the trees." "But the spacecraft,"
began Gallor. Jotun cut him off.
"Poor choice."
Varen's scowl deepened.
"You're giving us orders now." "I am asking for your help, cousin,"
Jotun insisted, turning back towards the camp proper. I have something else to deal with. It was hard work fighting in the narrow corridors, but Rubio threw himself into it, turning his sword into a whirlwind of blades. The proximity of the pariahs dulled his ethereal abilities, but not those that grew from his hard-trained battle experience. Empowered by psionic force or not, his sword was still a formidable weapon, and it tore apart the freakish host clusters of the mutant carrion flies. Each suited form that was ripped open exploded into another screaming swarm, impelled from the ragged remains of whatever unfortunate fool had become their living, walking breeding ground. Some of the things inside the environment suits were not quite as far along that route of ghastly transformation, and their mutations were some steps past the bloated bodies of the flyblown. These ones resembled some hellish mixture of human form and insectoid, with mouths that had grown into chattering maws of mandibles, eyes into jewel-like compound orbs, skin puckered with brittle, sharp hairs and questing feelers. They died as readily as any foe, however, and Rubio let himself settle into the pace of the fight, calling on his training to maintain focus and destroy anything that came to meet him. Still, the sheer numbers of the enemy were pushing him back, but then he had never intended to hold this position, only delay the inevitable. "Theoretical," said a voice in the back of his mind. "How long can one warrior prevent an advance through a tactical choke point, given these limited engagement options?" The voice was a memory of a craggy-faced instructor, lost to time and other wars. "Practical? Until his sword breaks, or his will does." "Neither will happen today," Rubio spat. "Varan, what is your status?" "We have the crawlers and the captives are embarked," came the reply. "Disengage and get clear."
He sensed he had missed a step, but in the thick of the fight there was little time to ask for a clarification. Rubio trusted Varan and nodded to himself.
"Understood. Exfiltrating now."
A pair of chattering mutants threw themselves at him as he spoke, and Rubio cut one into chunks of fouled meat, punching the other into a black smear across a bulkhead. Jerking backwards, he pulled a crack grenade from his belt and thumbed the explosive to arm it. Rubio hurled the device into the creatures as they scrambled over the bodies of their kindred to reach him, and then sprinted away. The grenade's concussive detonation made the rusted walls flex and tremble, but he was out and free before part of the framework collapsed. Spotlights atop one of the many-legged crawlers stabbed out and illuminated a path for him as the two vehicles scuttled away across the clearing beyond the camp. Rubio chanced a look over his shoulder and saw the same kind of seething swarm that had fed upon the populace of the walking city. It writhed and howled, gathering mass in preparation for what would be its next brutal attack. Now, as then, Rubio and the others were not best equipped to deal with such a threat, but the legions were made to be weapons, and a weapon would always find a way. He leapt high, grabbing a rung on one of the crawler's legs, hauling himself up onto the vehicle's back, panting with effort. Looking back, Rubio could see Galor had squeezed himself into the command cab at the rear, using the twin-stick controls to guide the machine away. Varan was driving the other crawler, and through vents in the iron hull, Rubio could peer into the cargo bays beneath. He saw pale, blank-eyed faces looking up at him. Looking, but not seeing.
"Is Jotun with us?"
He glanced over at Varan and saw the other warrior shake his head.
"He went back."
"For what?"
Any answer Varan might have given was drowned out in the thunderous roar of thrusters.
The bullet-shaped ship on the landing pad spat white fire from its engine nozzles and rose off the ground. All at once, it was clear where Jotun had gone. For a second, Rubio experienced disappointment, regretful that the unfamiliar knight-errant had decided to abandon them, but only for a second. Before it had even risen to the height of the acid rainforest tree canopy, the cargo ship shuddered as the power of its thrusters faded, lift negated by mass. It groaned and began to tail-slide back down towards the pad and the encampment. The flames from the engine washed across the makeshift tents and incinerated them, boiling back up into a churn of fire that whipped towards the gargantuan swarm of carrion flies.
Rubio ducked, bringing up his arm to shield his face as the ship struck the ground and exploded, consumed in a second wave of fire that grew to smother the encampment and everything in it. The crawlers were already deep into the trees, but the blast wave still buffeted them and threw plumes of burning fuel over Rubio's head in searing arcs. Galor cursed as the spider machine skidded out of control into a dense thicket.
"I believe that answers the question," said Varan. Did he get out?"
Galor stared back at the wall of flames. Rubio tried vainly to push out a telepathic call, but the deleterious presence of the pariahs made it impossible. At length he released a sigh and signalled for the others to move on.
"Head back to the rendezvous point. We will honour Jotun's sacrifice along with all the others," said Galor.
"Honour it where?" Rubio asked himself.
The truth was, no Hall of Heroes existed for the Knights Errant, no statues or memoria to recall their service and their passing.
"Perhaps we need to build one ourselves," he considered,
as he climbed down into the cargo bay to ride out the rest of the journey. Inside, the captives continued their muttering, and Rubio listened as the vehicle lurched on through the forest. Like repeating tones played at variant intervals, sometimes the words and half-sounds they would make came together in brief, sporadic synchrony. At times he fancied they could be stanzas of poetry or shards of old, forgotten myths. Then, very clearly, he heard the broken chorus say the words that made his hearts seize in his chest.
"Horus, come, Malkador, seek."
Rubio sprang to his feet.
"What did you say?"
he snapped, looking wildly from one blank face to another.
"Answer me, say it! Say it again!"
"Seek peace,"
said the chorus, before it broke apart once more into unintelligible babble.